Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's Senate occasional lecture. In welcoming you, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land where we meet, the Ngambri and the Ngunnawal people, and to pay respect to all Indigenous elders, past and present. Now, those of you who are alert, and that's all of you, may recognise this is the room where the Prime Minister last Sunday held a press conference after his visit to Yarralumla and announced that we would be having a double dissolution election, which is all terribly exciting for parliamentary nerds like me and my staff. But you can't have escaped concerns, levels of concerns expressed for quite some time about the level of engagement with our political and democratic processes, particularly among our young people, where the Australian Electoral Commission tells us that it estimates about 18% of 18 to 24-year-olds are not enrolled. And someone equated that to about four electorates, the House of Representatives. So that's a pretty alarming thing. So we thought it would be a very good idea to have a distinguished person along to speak to us about representative politics and its many aspects and angles. And today I'm very pleased that we have Professor Simon Tormey with us. He's an international scholar with an international reputation and an international background. I think he was born in the Republic of Ireland, educated in Wales, has taught at the universities of Leicester and Nottingham in England. And now he is he's Professor of Political Theory and Head of the School of Social and Political Sciences at my alma mater, the University of Sydney. He's written widely on political theory and related topics. And it's a great pleasure today to introduce Professor Simon Tormey to speak to you about the crisis of representation. Please join me in welcoming Simon Tormey.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. And I'd also like to pay my respects to elders past and present. And thank you all for coming. What a surprising... I was expecting about six people to be here, but I'm very pleasantly surprised. I have to report that when I mentioned to one of my colleagues yesterday I was going to talk about the crisis of representation at the Australian Senate, he said, that's a bit like going to the Vatican to talk about the end of Catholicism, isn't it? So don't be too harsh on me. Then another colleague posted something on my Facebook page which said, well, it'll be fine because here's a clip from Paul Keating's speech in 1984 where he, some of you will remember this, where he accused the members of the lower house of acting like members of the upper house, the Senate, in being unrepresentative swill was the term that Paul Keating used. So clearly I'm amongst friends and also that we can pose the question of representation very easily amongst the fine surroundings of Senate, knowing that as unrepresentative swill, they don't really care about who they represent anyway. So that's a bit of a flippant start. As I was introduced as a political theorist, not as a political scientist, this is not going to be death by a lot of data, although it will be necessary to the story to just give you a little bit of insight into the data in order to just kind of assure you that we know what's actually happening out there and that there is a story to be told. Now, I've been told to keep things to about 40 minutes. I'll do that so that we can have some questions. And it's going to be fairly brisk, quite conceptual, knockabout stuff, really. I mean, I'm not pretending that this is a kind of a high-end academic presentation. It's really designed to provoke a bit of thinking about the kind of context that we find ourselves in today. So this little bit of overview of what I'm trying to do in the presentation. We're talking about the crisis of representative politics. First of all, it's going to be necessary to say a little bit about what's happening. So why are we talking about a crisis of representation? Is there really such a thing? Is it uneven or even across the advanced democracies. Why is it happening? So I, as you can tell, I'm not the first person to have an interest in this topic. It's actually something which is very much the a debating point amongst political scientists, political theorists, political commentary. It's something which arises all the time in the press and media about what the state of our politics is like. So just a little bit of an overview of some of the competing explanations. What does all this mean for politics? So what are the takeaways in terms of are these things permanent features of political life, or can we look forward to a reinvigoration, re-enhancement with representative institutions? And lastly, of course, you'll want to know a little bit about what all this means for democracy in the wider setting. So without any further ado, let's give you a little bit of a sense of what we mean by crisis here. So when I started thinking about this topic with a view to writing about it in my sabbatical 2013, I kind of alighted on four variables, four coordinates, which would give us a kind of an insight into what the nature of the crisis is. So firstly, a decline in voter turnout, especially subnational and supranational, but also at the national level. And I'll put up a few little graphs snatched off the internet in a minute just to reinforce the point. Decline in membership of political parties. Again, going to come back to these things. I'm just giving you a little overview here. Decline in trust in politicians. Well, that doesn't need a lot of reinforcement, I suspect, in this audience. And a decline in interest in parliamentary affairs. And how do we capture that? So let's have a look at the data, just give us a sense of what's going on out there in the world of politics. So here's a little snapshot. It's not fabulously up to date. 2010 is where it ends. But what it shows you, this is voting turnout at national elections in some select countries. So you'll see there, for example, the US presidential is in red, so it starts off about 65%. Gentle decline, few bumps and so on before coming back in the 2000s, some of the contentious elections there. A UK general election is the one in purple, so used to start off in the 1960s, roughly 78, 79% turnout, and then as you can see, as you get into the 1990s, 1995, the purple line falls off a cliff. And we're into something which the British press regarded with great sort of doom-laden signals as harbouring the end of British representative democracy. German federal is in orange there, so Germans usually fairly punctilious about getting out to vote, but they've not escaped. 90% at some stage, heading down towards 70%. Japan, you can see there in green, zigzagging across the middle of the screen. And finally, India, very stable Indian democracy, maybe even heading up a little bit. Now, if we had a line for Australia, it would tell a very different story. We'd go right across the top there, 99% turnout. Why is that? Well, it's compulsory to vote in this country, as I shall shortly find out. My first election as a newly minted Australian citizen coming up on the rails. So looking at that, it's a kind of, there's lots of debate and contention amongst political scientists about what these kind of numbers mean. If we were to drill down or up into the next layers, we would see a much starker picture, actually. So when we go to the subnational, in other words, local elections, we see a real kind of precipice fall across things like voting for the European Union Parliament at supranational level, voting in local council elections in the UK. When I was lecturing in the UK, I'd give an example of a constituency in the northwest of the UK, which for one local, this is the national elections at the local level, had fewer than 10% of the electorate turn out to cast a vote. Actually, the overall picture in the UK for local elections at the last election, fewer people voted in the local council than they did in the Eurovision Song Contest. So we can vote when we are inspired by something which is significant and eye-catching, but it might be X Factor, it might be Eurovision Song Contest, or whatever. So what we've got here, voter turnout, a picture, really, if you look at kind of the data, the big takeaway is the heyday of voting, of suffrage, is really in the 1960s. I mean, that's what a lot of the charts will tell us, is that if we're going to measure the vigour and health of liberal democracies across the world by voting, then you'd say the end of the 1950s, 1960s, that was the heyday. And since then, we've seen some cases precipitate decline, other kind of slightly mixed pictures, but general decline across most important measures. Party membership is actually probably a more dramatic picture than is voting. Voting, as we can see, a little bit depends on what you're going to look at. But party membership, this is out of quite a famous study now, Paul Whiteley's data that he presented in 2010. And the picture looks a bit like this. Australia mirrors the UK, and UK mirrors Australia. Roughly 30% of the voting population in the 1960s would have been a member of a political party. So one in three people sitting in this room would have been happy to put their hand up and say, I'm a member of a political party. And some are still proud of being members of political parties. Good on you. The number today in Australia, having looked it up fairly recently, 1.5% of the voting population is now a member of a political party. Now, you might say, well, so what? We've still got the political parties. The Libs are out there, Labour's out there, the Greens, they're all out there campaigning, and they'll be presenting candidates and so on. Does it really matter? Well, when we think about it, political parties really are the conveyor belt for the ordinary citizen who wants to be involved in mainstream electoral politics, who wants to have an influence in terms of what's going to happen at the election, what's going to happen in the legislative assemblies and so on. So that mass withdrawal, and the numbers are really quite significant. Again, the UK numbers come closer to mine. Conservative Labour in the UK, each about 2.5 to 3 million members in the UK in the 1960s. Today, 250,000, 300,000. And of course, the demographic is also a very significant thing. The average age of the Conservative Party at the moment is 69 years old. Now, in this audience, you might say, well, those are youngsters. You know, plenty of vim and energy left to show around. But if we do have younger members of the audience as well, they're not joining political parties. Or some are, but it's an increasingly small number of people. So that major conduit, those kind of transmission wheels between assemblies, parliaments, legislation and the citizenry, it's drying up. It's a pretty desperate picture. Trust in politicians, this is one, again, scalped off the internet. I've got more data here, actually, but I won't bore the pants off you with all this stuff. But let's have a look at this trust survey. This is from the Republic of Ireland, my home country. At the top there, you can see I proudly stand. Professors are second in terms of most trusted profession, just behind doctors. We nudge down, teachers are up there, judges, scientists. As we go gently down, we'll see, at the bottom, government ministers, politicians generally. 83% regard politicians as untrustworthy, not telling the truth. Now, hot off the press, actually, very interesting document that some of my colleagues over here have been working on, which is looking at the Australian data. So there's been quite a lot of interest in this in Australia. There was a big study, Monash, 2 or 3 years ago, and the University of Canberra colleagues over here, big round of applause for them, for a major study on, and I'll give you the title of it, actually, because some people might like to but the director of the relevant post sent me this last night, so it's terribly exciting. And it's for the Museum of Australian Democracy, and it's called the Power of Us Survey. Big survey. Well done to those colleagues. What are the kind of key takeaways they say there? Let's just give you a little bit, because we're interested in Australia. 69% of those engaged with politics or civil society via at least one activity listed. So Australians are quite political. 69% of people are doing some politics. 46% had signed a petition quite recently. However, satisfaction with democracy, 42%, this is a very big N survey. How many people were surveyed, Paul? Do you know off the top of your head with this? I've put you on the spot here. It's a lot. It's a big study. 42% were satisfied with the way democracy works in Australia. 42%. So 58% are not satisfied with the way democracy operates in Australia. That seems to me quite extraordinary as I stroll around these halls here, very orderly kind of country as a relatively recent arrival. I think democracy works pretty well in Australia. There's a lively debate. It's very vigorous. There's a bit of swearing on TV, on radio and so on. But by and large, you know, it seems to work pretty well. But most of our fellow citizens don't think it's working well. That's interesting. 72% of Australians trusted the police. Only 34% trust the federal government. So Just a couple more numbers. 56% trust judges. That's not very high, is it? 56% of citizens trust judges. 24% trust trade unionists. Boo, hiss. Only one in four citizens actually trust trade unions. That's pretty desperate. And here, as opposed to the Irish data, 25% trusted government ministers. A quarter of the electorate trust. It can go on like that. It's very interesting data, if you can get hold of it. It's a big report, Museum of Democracy. You know, we've got a desperate situation. We don't trust our politicians. We don't trust our ministers. We don't trust our government. Let's just press on. So this is a kind of cross-international bit of data. Only a couple more slides of this kind of nature, and then we'll move on to the kind of analysis. But if you look here, so you're looking at the scores on a 1 to 7, 7 being really do trust politicians, right down to 1 meaning don't trust them at all. You see in this 2010 survey, Australia 4.9, right in the middle there, number 14 on that. Singaporeans are very, very enthralled to their own government. Denmark's very high up. We know there's kind of quite good sort of political capital out there in Scandinavia. Have a look towards the bottom. Germany, 4.1. Just ahead of Azerbaijan. China at 42. Underneath China, the United States of America. So American citizens in particular, very, very sceptical and wary of their own politicians. And of course, that's also reflected in the voting data. Those of you who can recall back there, generally in the US presidential election, and we're coming up to one, of course, roughly 60% of American citizens can make it out the door once every 4 years to put an X on a ballot paper to vote in their own presidential election. Quite extraordinary. 40% of people not going anywhere near it. Nearly half the population does not vote in the election. So let me just say something about interest in politics as well, because this is an audience which is interested in politics. Where do you get your information from? When you look at the data, for example, about newspaper coverage of mainstream and electoral politics, again, going back to the 1960s, pick up a copy of the London Times or the Australian, you'll see a very serious coverage of politics. So London Times, the data that I saw, something like 4 full sheets of paper covering mainstream electoral cabinet-based politics in the 1960s, and doing so, if you look at it, in tones which are very measured, dignified, reporting, this is what's happening in this committee, these are the major initiatives that the British government is trying to push ahead, and so on. If you looked at the London Times today, and it's still part of the Murdoch press, like the Australian, you'd be lucky to see a quarter of one sheet of the London Times devoted to electoral mainstream parliamentary reporting. Now, of course, what the media will say, what the press will say, is that's a reflection of us. They're in the business of selling newspapers. If we're not interested in mainstream elections and parliamentary reporting, then they won't have very much of it in. So what is in the London Times today? Well, I barely need to kind of remind you, an awful lot of sport, an awful lot of celebrities, an awful lot of salacious gossip about politicians and all the rest of it. What's lacking is really any kind of serious analysis anymore, okay? I'm actually quite impressed. I mean, again, I can speak as a kind of newly minted, but fairly fresh here. I mean, the Australia at the moment, actually, you know, 3 or 4 pages of electoral coverage. I mean, that you don't actually get that in the UK in the same measure. So, you know, I want to temper it a little bit. I think there is some serious reporting going on. It's not desperation stakes, but I'm wondering how many people actually read that stuff. I looked around the plane today from Sydney to Canberra. How many people are immersed in the detail of the election campaign? Not very many had the Australian or even the Fin Review open. They were doing other things, tapping away on iPads, filling out crosswords, getting ready for board meetings and so on. I was the only one, I think, on the plane who was reading this stuff. Okay, what's going on? So I promised you just a little snapshot of the kind of political science literature here. Look at that lovely text on the left-hand side. A friend of mine, Colin Hay there, Why We Hate Politics. So no kind of concession here. Well, maybe it's not too bad. We hate politics. Great sort of money-grabbing sort of title for a book there. A colleague of mine at Sydney, very well known for her data gathering on this, Pippa Norris, The Democratic Deficit, Post-Democracy, a very famous text by Colin Crouch based at the EUI there in Europe. And there are three kinds of big, large-scale kinds of explanation going on here. I mean, starting at the bottom, really, of those three, the decadence of citizens and or politicians. So there is a very strong thrust in the literature about the failings of politicians. The current political class, clearly out of touch. What did Peter Credlin call Malcolm Turnbull? Harbourside Mansion kind of thing, you know, he's off, he didn't want to go in the shopping centre in Penrith, why not? Because he looks patrician and plutocratic and they're all going to throw buns at him and all the rest of it, and it's not going to look very good on telly, so I better get out there and just keep things. And he still gets assaulted by a single parent there who's like, what are you doing for me? So the political class, lots of texts reflect on this. Very good book by Matthew Flinders, actually, called Defending Politics, where he really takes to task this idea that the politicians and political class are to blame. He turns it round and he says, we're the problem, not politicians. The classic formula in electoral politics is, of course, that we want to pay less tax and have better public services. Those two things are going in opposite directions. If we pay less tax, our public services are not actually going to get any better. They're going to get worse. And this is something that the ordinary electorate seems to think there's a magic trick somewhere in this building here where you can produce more for less. And we have become, in a sense, our expectation levels are just far too high. They're far too high about what politics can deliver. They're far too high about what politicians are like. We expect a level of virtue in our politicians which we don't match in our own private lives. All of a sudden, in other words, we have, in a sense, become so exalted in relation to the political class that, of course, it appears to be in crisis because they can't match our expectations. So that book, Matthew Flinders, is actually a kind of admonition to us to, in his phrase, grow up, be a bit more sensible about what you think about politics and what you expect from the political process. Because if we have a sense of proportion, good humour, and we treat politicians like any other person, we will have a kind of political system which, in a sense, is responsive to particular needs, but it's never going to solve all the problems that we have in Australia or elsewhere. So Colin Hayes' text, for example, talks about, in more general sort of political economy terms, as we would say in the trade, about the depoliticising effects of the policies which were very widespread across the world from the middle of the 1970s onwards. Some of my colleagues would call that neoliberalism. So the idea, in other words, that we can transform political problems really into problems which are matched by the market. So we privatise hospitals, we privatise education, we privatise aspects of the public services. We depoliticise, in other words, we take out of the public realm public services and we put them in the hands of very competent technocrats and put them in the market and so on. Colin, basically, his argument is that this has collapsed our faith in the public realm and in politics. It's no surprise, in other words, that we don't really fancy voting anymore, that we don't want to get engaged. Why? Because politics itself has denuded the public realm of any relevance or meaning for us. So this, of course, again, British context, European context, but also in Australia, we've seen some of the same patterns re-emerge, that the argument is that the more that we put into the marketplace, the better off our public services will become. And this is a denuding of the public sphere and therefore of democracy. And then, finally, arguments about globalisation. I'll come to this a little bit more, but the argument here about globalisation, which of course we're accelerating at a rapid rate of knots, is that many of the things that national governments used to look after are really so influenced now by flows of trade, by economic agreements, by overseas treaties and so on, that in a sense we can't not help but see the nation state as itself in crisis, and along with it, therefore, national politics. Much of the wealth and stature of Australia is, as we know, as a result of trade with China, for example. So those trade pacts with China really are not kind of subject to ordinary political processes. They're things that we put in place in order to guarantee and safeguard our well-being. So as Australia enters the global economy, so in a sense, less important become the day-to-day decisions of politicians. Much more important to be on just equitable, sort of friendly terms with our neighbours and so on, and allow those macroeconomic processes to weave their course. So politics, that sense of a nation state as dictating, as being the centre of political life, of a kind that I think would be recognisable to many people in this room, is just subject to so many transnational forces that we no longer regard it as relevant to be thinking centrally about the state and its forces. So my view, when I was developing the hypothesis in the book, I wanted to take an even longer range view of some of these things. What we call this in the trade, again, a view about how modernity is a terribly posh dinner party term, I know, but it's very extant in the kind of sociological literature. Why is that? Because, to go back to that previous slide, the problem with some of these explanations is that, in a sense, it implies that if only citizens renewed interest, or if only the political class got better, we could imagine going back to the heyday of liberal democratic politics of the kind that we had in the 1960s. That seemed to me terribly unlikely when I was looking at the literature and looking at the kind of forces and phenomena. So I really wanted to counter that view, that there is a kind of a prospect for recuperating that nation-state-based liberal democratic style of mass party politics of a kind that we saw in that. I don't buy it. Don't see it. And so what I wanted to do in the book and in these talks is to try and convince you that actually what we're seeing is a basic transformation in how society, economy, polity operate and function in the 21st century. We're never going to go back to those sort of that sort of heyday golden age moment. And here are some of the factors that I wanted to cover and write about in the course of sort of my own narrative about these things, just to sort of clip through them at a little bit of a pace here. I mean, some of these are very obvious, some of them less so, I think. Disruption of traditional patterns of authority and identity. So if we think about that coverage that I was saying about the London Times or the Australian, about what politicians felt, what does it feel like to be reading and thinking about what a politician was in the 1960s, 1950s? Think about the great figures, you know, Churchill, Charles de Gaulle, Roosevelt and so on. These were figures of just, they've come through, of course, life-changing, world-changing events, Second World War and so on. But they had a kind of, they exuded a sort of charismatic, exemplary, virtuous, they were just kind of above the fray, above politics. They had an aura about them, which we kind of commonly associate with sort of the monarchy, if you like. They were monarchic figures. And that also stemmed from very kind of traditional patterns of authority and identity. Great respect for doctors, great respect for teachers, great respect for university professors even. And we know that these kind of patterns of seeing ourselves as, in a sense, accepting of and enthralled to a pyramid structure in society is just collapsing. It's not just trust in politicians, which is in crisis. It's trust in all authority figures, yeah? Whether it be doctors or professors or whatever it is, or parents even, you'll recognise that there are enormous pressures on that sort of matrix-style hierarchy of society. Second point there, transnationalism. So just the degree of interaction between ourselves and the outside world, as figured by migration, for example. So just take my own example. So I was born in Ireland, moved to London with my parents, married a French woman, and we have children who don't know where the hell they're from because they now live in Australia. And they sometimes say they're French and English and Irish. Depends on who's winning soccer or rugby or anything like that. And there'll be many people in the room who've got the same kind of background. You've come from somewhere else. You're making your home afresh. You don't have those habits, those political habits that are passed down from generation to generation. And we know from the data that habits are incredibly important in politics. So you tend to vote like your parents did. Your parents vote like your grandparents did. But if you disrupt these patterns, family patterns due to migration, if, for example, an area like I had my university education in South Wales, huge disruption in South Wales, which, not New South Wales, old South Wales, the collapse of the mining industry. So what did that for? It forced people to go to London. It forced people to go abroad to look for work and so on. The habits are sundered. We're no longer in that kind of intimate social proximity. We no longer have, as Robert Putnam puts it, that social capital which dictates our political habits, our political beliefs and values. We are kind of thrown into a sort of swarm, if you like. So touching on that South Wales example reminds us as well, post-Fordism and precarious labour. The old class structures that's so familiar and which provided that guidance to your political allegiance, working class people voting Labour, middle class people voting Liberal. Well, the BBC, when I was researching this book, came out with a new study which said there's no longer two classes, three classes, there's seven different classes, and of course much higher kind of rotation and mobility between them, not from number seven to number one, but from number seven to number six, six to five, and so on. And this itself is disruptive. It's no longer the case that a self-identifying working-class person might, in a sense, vote in accordance with their class interests. Those kinds of things that we're familiar with sociologically have also disappeared. Decline of aggregate identities like class, therefore. Individualization, personalization. These are the sociological themes of our era, that we, in a sense, have escaped from, if you want to put it in those terms, or we are no longer thinking of ourselves as part of some collective identity, some collective ideology. We no longer kind of share group aspirations, group or collective aspirations, which could then translate into a political project. So Jean-François Léotard famously used this phrase, the exhaustion of meta-narratives. That's a terribly kind of academic way of putting things. But it's a famous thing because it was in a book called The Postmodern Condition. And it popularized this term postmodern to cover basically sociologically what was going on in the world, the disruption of the fundamental pattern of modern life. Just going on a little bit now, emergence of new technological capacities that shift organizational life towards networks and away from fixed hierarchies. Part of the same story that we've been telling. We're no longer tied necessarily even to the workplace. Many people work from home. Many people work on the road. We've got all sorts of ways of interacting with people which disrupt that sort of hierarchy, that sort of classic ways of thinking about who we are, where we're going, which people we're going to interact with. Ridiculous ease of interacting with others. So one of the things that we're noticing, very exciting for political scientists, so this is a phrase from Clay Shirky. God, what's the name of that book? Jean-Paul, what's the name of Clay Shirky book? It's a very good book. I want to get the title out there because it's one of those things, and you can't look it up on the internet now. Somebody else, can they remind me what it is? Clay Shirky, kind of very brilliant kind of contemporary sociologist of digital disruption, and he uses this phrase, the ridiculous ease of creating groups. The takeaway, which we'll talk about in a sec, is do we actually need political parties when it's so easy to find other people to find common cause with? And if you're passionate about the fate of the Antarctic penguin, no point joining the Green Party or the Labour Party. I can find the other people who care about the Antarctic penguin by Twitter, by Facebook, by other kinds of electronic platform, and we can hold a little campaign meeting to decide what we're going to do about that. So bitterness, morselation, different ways of interacting because of the ease of finding others using ICT platforms is, of course, itself disruptive of the traditional pattern of political organisation, where once we had to affiliate to a political party in order to have our voice heard, now many people, particularly young people, of course, they say, I don't need to join the Labour Party in order to plan a campaign around deregulation of university fees. I find others by going online and checking out who else at Sydney Uni is animated as much as I am. So that also just translates the nature of politics itself. So instead of big thematic blocks like socialism or communism, we now have a politics which is based about what I would call kind of specific injustices. Many of our student colleagues, if you like, they're very animated about injustices, climate change, the fate of sex workers in Thailand, and they'll pour all those energies into those things, not with a view to changing the world, but with a view to addressing that very specific injustice. So they will bypass electoral politics, parliamentary politics, because they're animated about something which cannot be captured by elections and by parliaments. They'd rather just go straight to the action as they see it. Yeah? It's very, very signal change in the habits of young people in particular when armed with ICT. So communicative abundance, the passive old media versus the active new media. We're no longer dependent on the Australian or the London Times in order to get our information. We're now getting it off the internet, and we are now creating content. Indie media, not a big phenomenon in Australia, but certainly in the US and in Europe, very big. Don't read the media, be the media. That's a very kind of declarative 21st century phrase. So instead of passively consuming what it is that elites want you to read, you generate your own data, you tweet out photos, you interact with others, you use hashtags in order to mobilize your friends. So we're in the midst of a very, very sharp change here. And what's happening to politics? A nice, easy-to-read table. That's what we love for teaching purposes, a table. And it's only got two columns. I'm not going into deep complexity here. But I just want to kind of round up all this stuff for you so that you can see kind of how it cashes out in readily assimilable terms. So the old politics, if you like, around interests, ideologies and identities being replaced, I think, this is my analysis, don't have to share it, but it would help if you do, affinities, values, and needs. So this kind of politics of injustice is being kind of an animating aspect of contemporary life. Old politics is about positional leadership. Why should we respect the Prime Minister? Well, because he's the Prime Minister. Not because of who he is, it's because of what he is. Why should we respect these positions of authority? This is really how, in a sense, the world is changing, that we now, if you sense the new political figures, and I'll come on to some of those in a minute, exemplary charismatic leadership. So the kind of whole nature and style of leadership. And those of you who work in kind of large organizations, you'll recognize this in leadership training. And those of you who work in business or those of you who are in organizations, you hear whiffs of this now in terms of leadership training. Well, what kind of leader do you want to be? Do you want to be the one who uses positional leadership to bully your and harass your colleagues into doing whatever they're told? You can't do that. You now need emotional intelligence. You now need to tell stories to your colleagues and to your staff and so on. You now need to mimic this kind of charismatic style of leadership. This isn't just confined to politics. This is kind of global changes at the level of kind of deep sociology. Permanent stable organizations, trade unions. What have we learned from trade unions from the Canberra study? Well, 3/4 of people don't even trust trade unions, never mind about wanting to join them. They seem too distant, too detached. Cronyism, clientelism, all those kind of things that also apply to political parties. So what kinds of things are people doing? They're creating other kinds of organization, more evanescent, temporary coalitions, alliances of interested parties. Also, there is just a big shift going. We're in the middle of it. It's right up in our faces, but sometimes it's almost, because it's so close to it, it's difficult to detect. But just think of it as an analogy here. I kind of use this with the students. I think they kind of get it. The revolution underway in terms of retail shopping experience. You know, 10 years ago, everybody went to shops, and now the online, the digital interface has completely revolutionized that experience. And that, I think the same thing is really underway for politics, that the digital disruptive effect that we find at retail, that we find in large organizations, in banks, for example. I mean, I never go to the bank. I'm sure there are people here who love going into the bank because they can chat with the teller. And I don't. I've got an app, NetBank. Do everything online, very easy, don't ever have to go to... Politics is becoming kind of app-like. We are experiencing it through a kind of electronic medium rather than through the sort of visceral emotion of confronting politicians and being involved in electoral campaigns. Newspapers, TV, film, as opposed to the internet, web 2, blogs, Facebook, Twitter. Representation, so the structures that support representation... Me giving you a mandate to go away and speak on my behalf, why would I do that? I want my own voice. I want to organize with my own friends. I want to have my own impact. Now, that's not to say that it has the same impact, but in our minds, if you like, is a shift away from mediation, trusting others, and this is the trust story as well, trusting others to do the best they can for me and my community, to actually engaging in it immediately and directly myself. This is part of the whole kind of shift that we're experiencing in the, whether it works or not, we'll come back to in questions. Yeah, definitely about, you know, what the takeaways are for this. Emancipation versus injustice, that's the story. I don't think, you know, the last revolutionary has quite sort of keeled over yet, but there aren't that many people who are able to convince us that a huge, great social transformation is actually something desired and needed. That's not the tenor or the note of today's political campaigns and causes. Now, time getting a little bit short here. I got sort of what sort of time do you want me to wrap up here?
Five
past. Okay, so I've been granted 9 minutes. This I'm going to touch on very lightly because it relates to the case study of the work that I did. So I'm a political theorist, but in order to give myself a bit of sort of ballast to write on, I did field work in Spain because the very eye-catching event happened in Spain in 2011. Anybody know what it is? I love pub quiz questions. What happened in Spain in 2011? The uprising of the indignados. I translate the indignados. You'll have to forgive me for the phrase, the pissed off, because it's really the only way you can translate that term, you know, capably into English. What happened was post-austerity, post-global financial crisis, just a complete lack of faith in what they call la casta, the political class. Through hashtags, through ICT-style mobilization, the European Union estimates that 6 to 8 million citizens went out on a protest on the 25th of May 2011 to occupy the squares of their own towns in 60 towns and cities across Spain. It's quite extraordinary. Have a look at it on the internet. You look at the Plaza del Sol in Madrid. Many of you have been to Madrid, beautiful city. Whole thing packed. They reckon there's 1 million people in the Plaza del Sol. What were they animated about? We've just had enough. Indignados. We've had enough of this policy. So I thought, wow, that's incredible, isn't it? A great big citizen upsurge. Let's go and talk to those guys, do some field work, travel around a bit, get a kind of sense of what's going on in the Spanish mind. Well, I mean, I'd love to stand and do another 40 minutes on this. I can't. But just to say, we've got a kind of book coming out called The Spanish Laboratory, The Democratic Laboratory of Spain. Because what's been going on is a quite extraordinary story of, in a sense, rejection of the old order, the old two-party cartel-style politics, and the emergence of all sorts of new initiatives. And I kind of sum them up a little bit here. Assemblies and direct styles of politics, flash initiatives, pop-up parties, a phrase I think I use first, that's probably out there as well, versus established parties, single-issue parties, networks, parties without politicians, movement or street parties, and a kind of phrase that we're working on, kind of connective politics. So just to round out the Spanish, really quite extraordinary developments. Some of you will know the result of the general election in December last year. Spain still doesn't have a government. It's had to call new elections because a two-party system that had operated for 40 years became a five-party system overnight, with Podemos, the kind of the main street party, polling 21% of the vote. Before that, even more extraordinary to my mind, was that pretty much overnight political parties captured the cities of Madrid and Barcelona in the municipal elections of the 24th of May 2015. From nowhere, zero time, 2 weeks of organising, Manuela Carmena, ex-communist 71-year-old judge, thorn in the side of the Franco regime, was elected mayor, a radical leftist mayor of Madrid, and Ada Colau, who'd been arrested more times than I've had hot dinners for anti-eviction protests, was elected mayor of Barcelona. It's got quite extraordinary. These people come out of nowhere, nobody. But such is the power of the moment that we're in terms of the signal disavowal of the inheritance of those two classic parties in Spain and the ability of activists to mobilize themselves along new lines, we get a very disruptive politics in Spain. And it's not just Spain, of course, but Spain was the one where, oh, I'm going to have a look at this. I can tell more about that in Q&A if you're interested. But, an important corrective here, because if you think it's all about progressive politics and that the life will be much better and we're going to have Ada Colau and lovely anti-austerity politicians, well, there's another side, as we know, of the collapsing centre of politics, of the Liberal Party and the Labour Party and of that kind of consensus which has guided democratic societies over the last 50 years. We've got these friends here. The new politics, not necessarily anti-representational, not necessarily in favour of participation and deliberation and all the rest of it. It can also be hyper-representational. And the term that we use as political scientists to describe this is populism. We can have populisms of the left and populisms of the right. But what unites all populism is an utter rejection of the existing political elites. So this is where the fire in the belly of populism comes from. Join me, you, the people, in our assault on Washington, in our assault on Madrid, in our assault on Canberra. Yeah, remember Pauline Hanson. Exactly the rhetoric and devices. The difference between the kind of Hanson period of, you know, 10, 15 years ago is these guys are actually very successful, right? Top left-hand corner, Pablo Iglesias of Podemos. We can, we the people, we can reject La Casta. We can project a new kind of politics. Our lovely friend here, Trump, bright orange face. My view is I think he's going to win, actually. Before anyone asks me this, I think he's going to make mincemeat of Hillary. So I think this grinning demeanour I chose for a reason, because I think he's actually onto a hot streak here. Bottom left-hand corner, recently departed figure Hugo Chavez, who kind of the Latin Americans kind of invented populism at one level, and he was very successful at kind of portraying himself as the saviour, the Bolivarian leader of the Venezuelan people against this terrible kind of white elites who had monopolised oil and so on. Bottom right-hand corner, little pub quiz question, who's that? Marine Le Pen, well done, colleague at the front there. Marine Le Pen, Front National in France. And if you don't think they're making inroads, they are. My wife is from the town of Cavaillon in Provence. About a third of the population of Cavaillon is actually of North African descent. So when they polled 50% of the vote in the recent municipal elections, you know you've got a major crisis. Nearly everybody who wasn't North African voted Front National. In the south of France, it's gone loopy-loop. They're absolutely on the march there, and I'm sure there'll be a breakthrough. It won't be a breakthrough in the presidential election because the two-party system that the French use is always going to squeeze them out. But further out from that, the municipal national elections, they will do extremely well. Okay, what does it mean for democracy? I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to recommend a couple of things for those who want to follow up. Just to say that the tenor of commentary is, of course, a bit doom-laden. Look at this one. John Keane, my lovely colleague in Sydney Uni, the life and death of democracy. Well, you'll be pleased to hear he doesn't actually document the death of democracy as such. He's kind of embarked on something kind of similar to me. How is it changing? What's it becoming? The phrase that he uses is the term monitory democracy. We're leaving behind representative democracy, and we're in a new phase of democracy, which is really about how multitudes of different organisations come to influence the policy process. I think one of the best theorists at this juncture as well is a guy called Pierre Rosanvallon in France, who's writing a book, for example, called Counter Democracy, where he mobilizes this sense of a demos, a democratic energies against the political class. It's a very common theme. And of course, I love as well Jacques Rancière, French, another French theorist, wrote a book called Hatred of Democracy. He loves democracy, I should say. But he thinks we've been duped by the enemies of democracy, that representation is actually an anti-democratic guise for preserving and protecting private interests, the interests of the elites versus us, and that therefore what we need to do is to reinvigorate a kind of an Athenian style of politics. We need to get out on the street, make a clamour, make a noise to reinvigorate democracy. Okay, so one more slide and then I'm done. 2 minutes, just a couple of key themes. What's the takeaway for you guys? Well, the most obvious one is that the erosion, what I think we're seeing here is the erosion of traditional party-based democracy in favour of a contest between old parties, mainstream and cartel parties, as they're sometimes called, and new parties and movements, which can be populist on the one hand or what we're calling connective on the other. So that old kind of pendulum swing between the centre-right and the centre-left, that's becoming disrupted across many parts of the world. And, of course, American politics, in a sense, betrays this even within the two-party system. So if you look at Saunders versus Clinton, Saunders, probably the first American politician to make any headway at all for the last 80 years calling himself a socialist. It's kind of, it has been for the last 80 years a write-off for the American electorate, right? But he stands there and he berates and he gets traction by calling himself a socialist. What we need is a socialist, you know, ooh, wow, what's going on in the US? And then, of course, Trump versus the entire Republican mainstream. And we don't quite know what Trump's actually going to do when he gets into power, but by God, it's not going to be the same as Mitt Romney, right? It's that kind of thing. Proliferation and multiplication of actors, so that's a bit of sort of technical jargon just to say I think we In a sense, what's interesting for us is that there are more things to look at which count as being politics in democracies, not just about political parties, but it's also about NGOs, it's also about social movements, also about all these pop-up and different and effervescent kinds. So in a sense, there's a kind of an enrichment of the ecology of democracy. You can tell I'm a half-glass-full kind of a person. I think, yes, we're seeing the emptying out of a certain brand of politics, but it's not to say that democracy is in crisis. If democracy means a bit more demos, a bit more us, and a bit less them down the corridors here, that might not be a bad thing. If that means that we can, in a sense, pluralise voices and get some of the things that we want politicians to take notice of, to take notice of them. A non-linear ecology of swarms, clouds, alliances, coalitions, clamour and all the rest of it. Growing legitimation deficits, of course, due to the continued decline of the aura of the old politics to solve problems and to mitigate risks. That's, I think, well covered. And then I want to leave you kind of, glass could be half full or it could be glass half empty. Let's just give you two little thoughts to end with there. The upside, I think we do detect here, there is a kind of clamour in certain parts of the world. Connective, deliberative, participatory forms of governance, and there are lots of experiments going on, way too many for me to document here. But on the other hand, of course, part of populism's appeal is that kind of tribalism, which, you know, retreat to America or retreat to a particular kind of demographic, a particular kind of ethnicity. Could be fundamentalist. So, you know, we know fundamentalism is also on the rise. It could be nationalisms. It could be other kinds of collective behaviours, notwithstanding that larger sociological kind of set of phenomenon that I documented. So just only a few copies remaining left of that book. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Simon, for that fabulously stimulating lecture. I'm not sure where we start, but if anyone would like to ask a question or has a comment, I'd invite you to come to the microphone. And we've already got a starter upstairs, so we might go upstairs to you first, sir, and then come down to you.
Is this on?
On the ground floor, and it's on. Yep. Off you go.
Today, the High Court ruled that the changes to the voting for the Senate is constitutional, is agreeable. I was wondering what you think the major parties will do to try and keep minor parties at bay. This was a reform to try and stop vote whisperers letting minor parties increase their representation in Parliament. Do you think there are going to be other things that the major parties try to do along the same vein?
Are monopolies interested in preserving monopolies? They most certainly are. I mean, I'm not sure I completely understand the Australian political system after 7 years being here. And I'm really looking forward to looking at that ballot paper and sort of, oh, my God, how many numbers and where does it go and up above the line and below the line. And the one minor party I know that will get my vote is the Australian Cyclist Party because I'm fed up of being knocked off Sydney's roads. No, to go back to the kind of serious point, I mean, obviously, we call these kind of parties cartel parties for a reason, because they have stitched up the political system. And the pendulum move between centre-right and centre-left is, of course, highly convenient for them. So it's no surprise to me, I suspect it's no surprise to you, that they will, by hook or by crook, make it very difficult for new political parties to proliferate. And, of course, we've got a political system, a parliamentary system, as in Britain. In Britain, it's exactly the same thing. Very difficult for my small parties, third parties, the Green Party, to break through. Why? In the British system, no constituencies. Well, first past the post, that kind of more or less rules things out. So the only way in which that minoritarian vigour can come through here, as it seems to me, is in the Senate. And I think it would be a danger and be wrong to try to close down the sense of the Senate as being a place where you do hear odd voices, different voices, idiosyncratic voices. There is a problem, I think, about, you know, how many votes it takes in order to get that kind of representation. I mean, there'll be people in here who know an awful lot more about this than I. But the thought that a mere 2,000 votes in a country where, you know, 15 million people are voting can get you a seat in Senate, it does sound very disproportionate if that's the case. And so therefore, proportionality, if you're going to have representation, then it needs to be proportional and it needs to be organised in a way which doesn't lead to a kind of Looney Tune politics as well, because I think that's also of frustration. Whatever criticisms you have of parliamentary systems, having some clarity of what it is that the government's going to do without reference to all the particularistic needs of tiny minority parties is, I think, a source of stability. I mean, that's a very unfashionable view, but I think, given the scale of the nature of the problems that confront national governments, some clarity, some ability to see them in action do things and then hold them accountable is of the essence of the political system. And that doesn't always seem to be apparent in the Australian system.
Thank you very much for your talk. It was fantastic. My name's Trish, so just in transparency, I'm a Greens candidate for the federal election.
Hi, Trish.
And I just wanted to respond to, as someone out there, talking to people, door knocking, doing all the traditional things as well as on social media, there really seems to be a space, if not a vacuum, for connecting with people. And I just was wondering if you'd be able to comment on that, because it really is, people are wanting to connect. Thank you.
And good luck to you, Trish. I'm, I think, in one of the greenest constituencies of all in Balmain there in Sydney. So look forward to seeing you tromping the streets. Why is Trump... I mean, upsides and downsides here, isn't it? So what social media does is to sort of compress that sense of distance. So if you see somebody tweeting, you kind of think that you've got a little bit of a relationship there. If you see someone's Facebook page, if you see the digital uploads of them in action and so on. So what social media does is just kind of compress that space between us and representatives. And that has an upside. I think it has a downside as well. So the upside is clearly that you can engage your constituents or your proto-constituents much more easily. You can put stuff out there. They can interact. They can tweet back and so on. I'm sure they do. The downside is, of course, that we then also engender a kind of an illusion of proximity. And this is something that Trump has done extremely well. It's almost that he's your friend, he's your buddy. As he tweets out, very kind of pugnacious, provocative, pungent kind of comments and so on, he can position himself as a kind of, one of us, one of the people facing that way because he's connected, because he's making these kind of pitches and so on. I just think that, the dangers of populism are actually quite clear in ICT. ICT, in other words, is I'm very sceptical of the view that we simply read ICT as a boon for democracy. It's also a boon for kind of would-be demagogues and would-be kind of monopolists of power, like I think Trump is, because what he can do is you say that old order there, those political parties, they're not interested in connecting to you. They're not interested in hearing for... And we know it's rubbish. Trump is not doing any of these tweets. He's got an army of people who he's paid for as a billionaire who are, in a sense, mobilising and manufacturing and pulsating with this kind of charismatic style of leadership. So upside and downside, I think we're in a very early phase of seeing how this is going to cash out. But I certainly think that if I was advising you on how to engage your constituents, of course, social media, ICT, is going to be one of those ways in which you can extend your reach, get some echoes back as well. And it's not just dog-nopping, but you'll also get a lunatic fringe. You'll get that guy who tweets back on every tweet that you send out, saying, Trish, you're talking rubbish. Trish, drop it. Trish, rah. You recognise it. Yeah. So you've got to be a bit careful.
Sir, at the back of the room, and then we'll come to you.
You describe what I take as we have at the moment one establishment frame of representative government here and another one out on the street. Is it appropriate that there be leadership from this formal establishment in trying to... Is it practical and is it appropriate to try and define a new form of social contract and its possible wiring diagram and its key aspects? Is that a role of leadership for this House?
Well, I wish it was, but I think politicians like things as they are. So, and this is the sense of the crisis, if you like, because politicians have been a bit slow, I think, adapting to the need, the desire, the hunger, ordinary people to participate, to be part of decision making, to be asked what they think about things. Because why? Because they're themselves monopolists. So if you're used to that sense of you're the one in power, you're the one accountable, that kind of noise from below can be a terrible distraction. I'm the one who's been elected to decide on development in Sydney or in Canberra, not you guys. So The problem is this kind of, you know, what is the role of a politician? Is a politician just the kind of avant-garde of the rest of the constituents? Or is that person supposed to, in a sense, push the constituents away and say... So this is an old debate, actually, in representative democracy. Edmund Burke wrote about this in reply to Tom Paine in the 1780s. Should a politician, in other words, be a delegate or a representative? And he said, well, basically what Marx represented to democracy is that we hear from the demos once every 3 or 4 years, not every day, not in a connected way, not in a participatory way, but you're the one who's accountable. So, and of course, then it goes back to the delegate model, that person should be... So in Spain, there's a lot of interest in making politicians delegates, making them instantly recallable, enforcing laws like you can only stand once in an election. So you don't become a kind of charismatic fulcrum for power, but that rather the people, the citizens, have a greater hold over them. I just think it's kind of, you know, I'd love to sit with kind of Trish and others here and talk about, you know, how much demand there is for participation, for extra engagement, for ordinary citizens to be involved, or are people just too busy, frankly? I mean, we're here because we're enjoying the political discourse, but out there are people just working, looking after children and so on. You know, and I think that the answers are very, very contextual. Spain, everyone seems to be a politician and highly interested. The taxi driver will bore you to tears about history of the Franco regime and so on. Other kind of contexts, well, maybe representation. I mean, in Australia, you know, crisis, what crisis at one level? Yeah, we don't trust, but the system operates, it goes along, it moves along, stuff gets done. You know, people seem a bit happier here. So it's a complex question. Sorry, it's a bit muddled all there.
For your question now.
Thank you for your talk. On the matter of the general citizen being involved, I wonder to what degree the capture of the political parties by political professional politicians and their staff is an issue. I think there are cases not far from here where the governing committee of parties are staffed by a majority of MLAs, of members, and of their staffers, which means for the general person who thinks, well, the matter's decided already, what's the point of the ordinary person getting involved? Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think it's just staffers. I mean, I think those of you who kind of work in this building, the lobbyists, the special interests, you know, they've got a voice that we don't have. Why? Because we haven't got money and we haven't got resource and we haven't got that kind of capital which interests politicians, because then it allows them. So there's an inequality of voice. That's kind of clearly the case. And you've pointed to one particular kind of instance of that, the staffers. But I think that, you know, one of the issues about democracy is that unless we hear more voices and unless voices, you know, have a chance to be involved in participation, then we'll probably find that either we're heading towards populism and towards the kind of TV mediatization of politics, or we're just going to kind of just have a sort of technocratic governance that really just operates behind our backs and without our input. And that's not a good thing. These numbers are alarming at one level. And I think staffers or those kind of monopolists who are propping up the cartel type of system, well, we need to sort of push back against that model. I think we need to be a bit more thinking about how we can hold politicians to account, not just once every 3 years, once every 5 years, but on a daily basis. We need a vigorous press. We need a vigorous kind of digitally enabled voice, an echo chamber for what people are thinking about. But I think some of those developments are actually happening as well. I mean, I'm sort of encouraged by what I see in certain contexts. But in Australia, I think we've got more work to do.
OK, so I think it's appropriate. Our last question comes from the voice of the future.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
So you mentioned a lot about a greater online presence and this through social groups and the ridiculous ease to communicate, but also figures like Donald Trump that represent a group that may not have had a voice before. This can sort of be contributed to globalisation and a new form of interconnectedness. Does globalisation have a role in the decrease of political interest as we are surrounded by the... global political issues rather than our own, causing once again less interest?
Good stuff. So a very complex question, stumped me completely here. I mean, the global level actually is the thing which many of our young people are most concerned about. So it is things like climate change, and it is the erosion of species, and it is global inequality, and it is the kind of... And the problem is that we don't really have developed institutions at the global level which help us to do anything other than to stimulate trade. So we've got this incredible, elaborate repertoire of mechanisms for freeing up markets and for, you know, capital flows and all the rest of it. But the politics has not followed the economics. And I think this is really the kind of kernel of your question. There's so much going on at the kind of global level, and yet where are the global institutions which would permit that kind of conversation about how we do things to work much better? I mean, has anyone heard from the UN recently about any major... I mean, it seems quite extraordinary that... For many decades, of course, was the kind of sense of a kind of global parliament or a nascent global parliament. And it seems to be completely moribund as an institution. Now, Trish is disagreeing, but the Paris Agreement. OK, so in climate change talks, there are subgroups of the UN which are acting and doing their work. But I think if you looked at, ISIS, for example, global security issues, I would have thought there'd be a much kind of a stronger voice, a more resonant voice of the international community there. But of course, what's happening is that nation states are themselves trying to assert their own primacy. So not just the US, of course, but Russia, China, Europe. And this is creating a bit of a clamour which makes it very difficult for international and global institutions to get any traction. But I think really to sort of come back to the introduction to the speaker, I mean, I think it is for the next generation to push for that kind of international dimension, that global dimension. They do it. Some of the most powerful political communities, online communities, are things like change.org, avaaz.org, not just GetUp. GetUp is an Australian thing, but there are lots of online communities which are actually able to report some interesting successes across the globe. So I think there are tools being developed. I think voices are being heard, but there's an awful lot more to do, and we need to think hard about how global governance is going to resolve some of the kind of really major and terrible problems of the 21st century. But thank you very much for your contribution.
Thanks, Simon, thank you. That was terrific. And I think we might have to get you back after our next election to interpret the results for us so we can see just where we're heading. But thank you all for coming out today. It's been a tremendously stimulating hour and a little bit. And I, for one, feel perfectly daunted by how this new populist, or whatever you call it, polity still fits into the traditional structures that, in our case, are mandated by a written constitution that we can't change very easily. No. So that's a challenge for people like me in working with the diversity of people that we all elect to our national parliament in this case. Please thank Simon and thank yourself.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we'll see you all back next time.
Yes.